Well, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We just have really only have one sponsor this week, which is kind of sad. We're going to have to fix that. But it's Environments for Humans, our longtime great sponsor. I think what we're going to push for them is in-person conference. So 2013.incontrolconference.com is In Control, a really nice web conference that's back in Orlando. So check out that. We'll tell you more about it later in the show. And we don't have a second one, so I'm going to say CodePen is our second sponsor.
Yeah.
Dang it.
All right.
Let's Great. Kick this thing off.
Working on the soundboard, guys.
There goes.
Welcome to episode 45 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about web design and development and front-endy stuff. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Christopher Coyer.
Hi, everybody. And with us, as usual, we have a guest with us. We have Harry Roberts, Mr. CSS Wizardry. Thanks for being on the show, Harry.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, see, that's you know, was that appropriate, Mr. CSS Wizardry? I know sometimes you've had your like ups and downs with the name.
Yeah, I chose the name a long time ago, and I'm kind of regretting it now. But no, it's cool. I've brought it upon myself.
You can change your Twitter name if you want. I did find out you don't lose your followers or anything.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. It's like 5 years old now. I mean, yeah. CSS Wizardry is as old as CSS Tricks. Yeah, so, I mean, totally. It's quite a risky thing to go changing now.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not changing mine.
Yeah.
We met one time, and I don't know, it's probably, I don't know, 8 months ago. It was a long time ago, and we were in Poland, Warsaw, Poland, at Front Trends.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Was that this weird, like, compound?
It was mad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was in the middle of nowhere, but it felt like a festival and a conference to me. All the beer and all the sun.
Yeah, it was a good time. So you know, as most of you know, this isn't too interviewy, but I'd like you to get a sense of who our guest is, so that before we dive into all our awesome drama and Q&A and stuff, you have a good sense of that. Harry works for BSkyB. Is that how? That's right.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just like a front-end architect kind of.
Yeah, my official job title is rather pretentious. It's I'm a senior UI developer, but I just spend all day writing CSS.
It's appropriate.
It is.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Cool. Oh, what do you got, Dave? Do you have something?
Harry, it's so good to have you on the show. You're maybe first guest who has come immediately following some little bit of hot drama, possibly with you know. So we had Zeldman on the show last week, and Zeldman, you know, obviously is very well known. He wrote a blog post, sort of refuting one of your blog posts, and then so now we have you on, and we're going to get your side of the story here on the whole.
It was all a big coincidence, by the way. I didn't even like craft this. Yeah, and it wasn't even a. It was kind of interesting because it was like this Harry's blog post. Like one, although you've been in the kind of don't use IDs to style for like a long time now. This isn't some new thing. The particular article that you wrote said like, I don't know, 20 things in it, and one of them way at the bottom happened to be don't use IDs. But that's what got focused on by Jeffrey, and he wrote an article right before coming on the show last week, and he said, you know, please read this because I want to talk about it. So we did, and we ended up not really talking a whole lot about it last week. But the gist of the article was that IDs are okay to style with. Don't be afraid of them. Use them in descendant selectors. That's what writing semantic HTML is all about. In reaction to that, so do you want to give us your perspective or background on this little thing?
yeah, I mean, so that blog post in general, yeah, you wrote your little article about dogmatism with stuff like that, and I don't know, I've been working in the kind of CSS architecture area for nearly 2 years now, and I honestly found that for me working on big sites, and for many people as well, I mean, Nicole Sullivan was the person who got me onto the idea of dropping IDs. It's just one of the quickest wins, in my opinion, to circumvent any real low-hanging fruit sort of obvious specificity problems. Mm. So it's a thing that I've been doing for like nearly 2 years now. And I honestly, and I'll continue to do so, I'd recommend it to anyone. But yeah, so Jeffrey hit upon, I didn't get a chance to read his article in full, but he was hitting upon the idea of semantics and IDs helping with semantics, but yeah, I personally, I'd say that's a weak argument because you can't glean semantics from IDs anyway. I mean, if a French person was to have an ID of bonjour and an English person was to call it ID equals hello, you can't glean semantics from such an arbitrary and subjective thing. So, I don't know. I think they're, yeah, by all means, like, people still use them. I'm not telling people not to. That article was written from the perspective of if I was in a code review at work, or if I was in a code review of someone on my team, things that I look out for.
Right, because it was a reaction to the question that I got on that cement, on that post. That was like, if you're doing a code review, what are things that you look for? And you prefaced it that said, this is a big site thing. To have this discussion outside of the scope of the project is pretty weird, I feel like, too, isn't it? Like, if you're designing a simple blog or whatever, and you use some IDs to do some styling, it probably doesn't evolve to the point where you're going to get bit by IDs.
I mean, with web development as well, I see a lot of it as a numbers game. So if you're working on a site that might take, I don't know, 6 months, and it's got 5 developers on it, and it's an enormous site, then statistically the chances of you hitting problems, they must be greater because there's more code to work with, there's more people tripping over each other. So, I mean, you've got to have context with these things, and I always sort of speak or write and speak from the point of view of a big site mentality. So, yeah, I think a lot of the ideas discussion gets taken out of context a lot of the time. I mean, I personally would never use an ID on a single pager, but I think what the whole debate at the moment has made me realise is that there's quite a lack of critical or analytical thinking. If you read anything online, and I'd say anything online, mm-hmm. you have to be able to put your own slant on things or your own perspective or your own context. You can't just take everything as black and white. And to do so, it illustrates, in my opinion, a lack of critical thinking.
Yeah.
Like if I found a recipe online and it said use mushrooms, I don't like mushrooms, so I probably wouldn't use mushrooms in that dish. But there's no way I'd start writing sort of a...
Sure.
You know,
but if that article also said, use mushrooms in this article, unless you don't like mushrooms, and then use this, and use cream. Yeah, totally. But if you don't like cream, use milk. Then it would be like, oh, God, can you just tell me what's in the article and let me bring my own perspective to it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, as well, like, yeah, anyone reading the kind of posts I've been putting out recently would... most likely, I'd imagine, be someone working on bigger websites. So they would come at it with the correct context. I mean, if you're wanting to learn how to scale a website, I'd imagine that would be useful information for you. If not, then yeah, apply your own project or work context to whatever you read. And I think that's true for anything you read should be treated with your own context.
Mm-hmm. And it's not up to the writer necessarily to bring that, well, you know, that like a lack of confidence to it. You know, one of your comments on my post was kind of like, I'm not dogmatic, but I am confident, right? I am, you know, I do want to say what I mean.
Yeah. I really regret that. I can totally see how it happens, but I do regret, and I'm not happy with that. I come across as dogmatic, or I may have come across as dogmatic, cause that's not my intention. But, yeah, so if you've got something to say, there's no point saying
it. I don't think it's necessarily just you and your writing that comes off across that way. It's just there's a risk of that, in anybody's article. In that, if we just be like, no IDs ever. And I was probably the worst offender with my. I have an article, a line in the sand that just says, no, never ever, never ever ever is an ID the right choice. Big site or small, whatever. And because it once you draw that line and you just even if it seems like a good idea, if you just never style with IDs, it improves your style. You know. I don't know, just the authoring experience overall. And yeah, I totally agree. Like, it feels good. Just give it a try.
That's another thing. This is quite an admission as well now, but when CSS Lint came out and CSS in general, I was one of the sort of people saying it was not a good idea, it wasn't a nice way to write CSS. And one day I just sort of gave it a try. And now I'm one of sort of CSS's biggest proponents. It's just give something a try before you write it off altogether. I spent years building with IDs, and it's not until you stop using them that you realize where they've been tripping you up.
Yeah, same exact story for me. Like, it feels like some of the peanut gallery, if you will, that are like, IDs are fine. They work for me. I've been using them since I was a web designer. I don't have any problems. You'd be like, yeah, but have you tried the other way? You know.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I think for me, the portability of classes seems the most convincing feature for me in the whole class versus ID debate, that you're able to, let's say, pagination. I just wrote one yesterday or something. You know, it's class pagination. You know, I don't have to, you know, and I can just like copy that, and I could probably paste this into any site ever, you know, and it's going to work, and I don't have to remember like, What is the div, you know, ID'd or whatever? So I feel like you have this like portability of your code, similar to Dan Cederholm's pairs thing. I just feel like you get classes and you're building these modules, these classes of style that can just kind of go anywhere, and they're a little markup dependent, but they're not like ID dependent. I think that's somewhat smart.
If you're looking at the Photoshop document and there's only one navigation on there, some people are like, oh, there's only one, so that's an ID. Like, ugh.
Yeah. But the thing is as well, like, even if there's only one, it doesn't mean there's only one design pattern in that thing. So your navigation, yeah, there might be one navigation on your website, but there could be, you know, similar traits like a horizontal list of links, and that could be abstracted out, and you can't do that with an ID. Mm-hmm. So it's all about breaking things down as well. I once did a talk, I say once, it was only a couple of months ago, and I was going to actually do a little matrix, a little list of pros and cons for, you know, IDs and classes. Mm-hmm. And I've got to admit, if you look at it purely objectively, the list of pros for classes far outweighs that for IDs. But again, look, if you want to use IDs, I can't stop you. I could recommend not doing so on a big website, but yeah, like, it's not my place to tell anyone what to do.
That's the, and right, and so that's the, you know, not that anybody's trying to be dogmatic, but the point is, it does work, right? You can't, it's not like it's, IDs don't work as styling hooks. They certainly do, and it's just another, you know, possible trick in the bag. What we're trying to avoid is this idea that, like, listen, I heard some smart guys talking about how you don't use IDs on the radio, and and now I'll never use one ever under any circumstances, where it's just that's not the right thing to do. Or like they'll twist and contort themselves into a weird problem just because they are refused to use an ID, even though in some weird situation it happens to be the right thing to do, you know. So just, yeah, you know, grain of salt, like, the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, say for example you got given a third-party widget and you couldn't get out the markup and all it had on it was an ID. I would recommend using an ID to target that rather than using some convoluted sort of CSS 3 style selector to select it on the third div in the DOM that's got a, you know, a P inside it or whatever. There are certain times when you'd have to use an ID and I'd have to use an ID, and, you know, it's just applying context and a bit more critical and analytical thinking. But yeah, it's just one of, like you say, one of many tips that, that you pick up and that you use when you're building websites. It's not for everyone, but it's certainly for me.
Yeah. All right. Maybe that's enough of that, huh?
Yeah, I reckon. Some kind of
finish up. We have like a sound effect for that's done. works. That works. Oh. That works. Dave dug up some hot drama right before. Not that that wasn't enough hot drama for one day.
I know. This is, I'm doubling the drama here, but I just got word or wind of this, but apparently Ellis Lab, the creators, maintainers of the popular, what would you call it, content management system, Expression Engine, they like changed a whole bunch of their policy and just how you get support and what it costs you per year and your licensing and stuff like that. They made like a huge kind of sweeping change. So it's kind of stirring up some dust over in the EE community. And I feel it's my duty to report on this.
I've never heard of this.
I just saw some posts right before we went on, and it's it's sort of kind of scary, and it's just brings up the kind of mindset of open source versus proprietary kind of software, and not that EE is extremely proprietary. It's very easy to build on, and it's just like kind of well-maintained open source, I guess you'd say, which I guess WordPress is as well. But what happens when you're kind of maintainer just changes, or your kind of life source changes how they bill you. That just seems sort of interesting kind of hot drama there.
Well, they don't have public forums anymore. That was what struck me as the biggest thing. So they charge $50 for support. That's fine. WordPress doesn't even have the ability to do paid support, as far as I know. Maybe they do. I'm pretty sure they don't, though. So you want to charge $50 for support, that's fine. But they're, like, to not have some public forum where people can help each other, that's weird. And did they have one before and they nuked it? So there's a bunch of dead URLs now to things that used to be helpful? I'm not sure if that's the case, but that's what it seems like. They're like, well, we don't even have free forums anymore, so... Too bad. Wow. It sounds like there used to be. Anyway, that's a little drama-esque. Yeah, I've never used EE ever once for anything.
No, nor have I.
I've tried multiple times, but it just came down to the need to it just has to be done like soon, rather than like me learning EE, and so I just switched to WordPress. But that said, Paravel, we just worked with a company who does a lot of EE, and they set us up. And I mean, it's super slick. It's really awesome in terms of what you can do with it. But I've never personally built anything on EE like with my own hands. So
I do feel like this a long time ago. I just arbitrarily decided to use WordPress. It looked nice to me. And then I used it and used it and used it. Then I started a job, at Chapman Design back in the day. And we used it for lots of different stuff, and it satisfied every single one of our clients' needs. Then I got really into it. Then I wrote a book about it, and it was really good to me. And I'm part of the community, and I go to WordCamps. And it feels like every move they make, and all over the years and years and years I've been involved with WordPress, they always, like, do the right thing. They always improve. Their standing in the community. That I just feel like vindicated that I picked WordPress early on, because like everything they do seems like the right thing. It's pretty nice. It feels good inside my body.
Yeah, I need to. I've not touched WordPress in ages. My site is in desperate need of a redesign, so I'll be picking WordPress up again soon.
Nice, but it's WordPress now. It's going to be new and improved.
Yeah.
You keep it up to date though, right? Yeah, it's on the radio, so tell everybody that you do, because
it's completely up to date. Completely, just before we came here, I was updating all my plugins. It's up to date.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, Q&A time. That was a good intro.
Cool.
Let's do some questions. We have some audio ones where audio is not working again. We had that one weird show where the audio didn't work, and I don't want to make the impression that you shouldn't send in audio questions. We want you to only send in audio questions if possible, because it just makes for a more homey podcast. So let's do this audio one first.
Here we go.
My name is Rodrigo from Mexico City, and I've heard you guys talk about SAS and Compass and Lewis and all these preprocessors. I have not yet got my aha moment, and I wonder if you guys could like just shine a little light as to how do they work and what are the advantages and disadvantages of using them.
Okay, that was Rodrigo. He's looking for his aha moment with CSS preprocessors.
Yeah, maybe you could share yours, Harry. Like,
Harry,
was that moment?
Yeah, mine was really recent as well. So since I started working at Sky, is when I started working on much, much bigger websites. So I spent the last sort of few years, well, a couple of years, focusing on how I could just scale vanilla CSS, making sure I had a better understanding of CSS at its core. And so I avoided pre-process for the longest time, and I feel really naive having done so. And it was a few months ago when I started, I got a little CSS framework called Inuit CSS. And I was using that. Rebuilding that, not on a preprocessor. And I was getting to a point where I was deciding too many things design-wise. I was pre-setting font sizes. I was telling you what your margin would be on your paragraphs and stuff. And it just felt a little wrong. And the solution to that for me was to store that information outside of the framework in a variable somewhere. And then the obvious answer to that would be grab a preprocessor. Someone can fill their variables in the framework, picks them up. And, I just started from there. Like I said, it must have been only a couple of months ago. And started off, really, as recent as that. So I started just by passing variables into one giant style sheet, put Inuit on GitHub. Someone asked if I could split all the elements of Inuit into their own style sheet. So I did that. And, I've absolutely loved it.
GitHub.com/CSSWizardry/Inuit.css.
Hey, there we go.
And then right at the root is _vars.scss. Is that where you – is that kind of one of the big features of Inuit is that you have this like vars document where you can decide how you want Inuit to work for you?
Yeah, definitely. So I find the failing or the problem with most CSS frameworks is they do decide too much of the design. Because obviously you have to put something in there. You have to have some like font size value on something. But so people always end up having to edit library code, which isn't a good idea. They shouldn't have to edit the bones of the framework because it's going to make it hard to upgrade in the future. So if you can extract all that information out to a series of variables that are controlled almost outside of the framework itself, it makes the framework much easier to update. It makes it much nicer to work with. It makes it much quicker to work with. And that was my aha moment, just needing variables. And then from there, sort of everything. I'm still, like I say, really new to SAS, but writing some fairly complex mixins at the moment to generate pure CSS triangles. And it's a lot of fun.
Nice. Cool. Yeah, so it started for Rodrigo. Harry's answer here is it started with the need for variables and then kind of once you're writing it, right, it's everything else. I'm sure you're using nesting and mixins and whatever.
What Chris, what was yours? What was like
the aha moment for pre-processing? Oh, that sucks. I should have been thinking about this probably.
I think for me it was being able to use partials, like the underscore module name .scss or whatever. I feel like that is crucial. You can do at imports and then it bakes down and then it's this totally compressed file, but I'm working in files that are totally uncompressed. That's what I love. I love like the optimization standpoint of it. It's just like, no, I'm going to minify my CSS, not some dumb plugin. Mm.
Yeah, totally. Because I got started on it where I was still at Wufoo, and we kind of just decided that we were going to go with them. And I looked at it as an excuse to, just do a lot of learning on it, but still get paid for it because it's my job, So I was like, yeah, I'm going to dig into this. Yeah. And the biggest led us to that we're going to definitely do this thing was that it was just getting a little ridiculous to update all of the vendor prefix stuff all the time. I mean, we just found it pretty regular to be like, oh, now this has settled down a lot, especially in the last, 6 months or so. There was a time where it was a lot more volatile about which prefixes were the proper ones to use for each of the different things. And it was like we were constantly going back through our whole project and figuring out places we were screwing it up and fixing it. And now that's just not a non-issue anymore. You write it how it was meant to be authored, and let a computer decide those other things.
Yeah, totally.
So great.
Cool. Well,
So Inuit does use. Is there any other pitch you want to give us? Sorry, Dave. Have something?
I want to hear all about Inuit.
Like, where does it sit in the world of things you might want to start a project with? You know, like, is it like Bootstrap? Like, is it like Foundation? Is it its own thing? Should people use this? Do you want people to start using this?
Well, of course, I'd like people to start using it, but it all depends on your project. So Bootstrap is absolutely fantastic if you need something to do the design for you, or, you know, you're a developer, you've got a weekend project you need to put on Hacker News, and you just throw a Bootstrap over the top of it, and it's presentable, and that's really cool, that's really useful. But if you're an agency and you need, you know, if you need to knock out maybe a couple of sites a fortnight, and you go back to the beginning of each one, everyone looks different, you've got a team of designers, but you find yourself building the same stuff over and over again, but just designed slightly different. So Inuit goes way back, way before any design phase, and it's just full of objects and abstractions and little reusable design patterns, which means that it could be used on almost any kind of project. Inuit doesn't make any design decisions. That's why I need the variables, so that you decide how big your headings are. You decide how big your line height is. All things like that, you decide yourself through the variables. And then you can just lay whatever color scheme or build your own components, extend your components. It's a really hands-off framework as far as design's concerned. So it lends itself really well to any kind of projects. We're using a fork of it in-house at Sky for a site we're working on. And it looks completely different to any site ever, as far as I'm aware. It's built on the same foundation as my CSSRigid.com redesign is going to be. So it's a completely stripped back, completely design free little library of objects and abstractions that can be used on pretty much any build.
And when you say design patterns, it's like, I'm trying to look through this list tables, the natural things that like actual elements. Yeah.
Well, we've got, yeah. So you've got your headings in there and you've passed in your variables.
I'm just saying, when I think of a design pattern, I'm like tabs, pop-up boxes, that type of thing. You don't deal with any of that, right? Or do you?
So, to an extent, yes. So, you might have a nav, which is just, you know, a UL, the list, the bullets taken off of it, everything's floated, it's all horizontal. To me, that's a design pattern. That could be a breadcrumb trail, that could be a list of links in the footer, it could be on site main nav. But all that can be abstracted out into a list with no bullet points and all the links in a horizontal line. So just abstract out that design pattern. It's not a breadcrumb yet, it's not a main nav yet. You add your colours, your paddings, your background colours and stuff, and you make it whatever component you need it to be. Anyone familiar with OOCSS will probably know Nicole Sullivan's media object. So that's in there, things like that. So it's just basically abstractions and design patterns rather than completed components, because it's up to the design team to decide what the component looks like. I can just build abstractions that lie underneath that.
Cool.
That's what lends itself really. That's why it lends itself really well to any kind of project. Really, every project can guarantee you will have a horizontal list of links in it somewhere. But it's up to you, the designer/developer, to decide how that looks.
Cool. Good intro. So this has come up before on Chop Talk Show when you use something like this. Mm-hmm. Is the proper way to use it to clone it or whatever? And then just don't touch it. Just leave it alone and then add your own kind of like custom, when you add those colors and paddings and make it your own and build on top of this thing, you don't touch anything inside here, or do you? That's kind of the big question, right? Because what if an update to Inuit comes along? If you go messing with this, you can't update it. But if you leave it alone and only build on top of it, you could.
Yeah, totally. That's exactly how it's built. So a lot of the complaints with, say, Bootstrap is, I used Bootstrap, but I had to go and change this, this, and this because it wasn't quite right for my website. If you only touch the variables file, Inuit picks that up, and the library code, the actual framework itself, will never need touching. And I've actually got it's full of comments. There's actually a comment in there which says, if you find yourself needing to touch anything in the framework, just raise an issue or fire me a tweet, because it's built so that you shouldn't have to do that. It means that, you know, the underlying framework says,
yeah,
sure.
It really is a framework. I think that's would be a way to define that.
Yeah, so calling Bootstrap a framework for me is a little incorrect. I'd call it a library or a component library or something. This is, for me, Inuit is a framework at its core.
What do you use, Dave? Do you use framework-y type stuff like this, or?
Not really, no. we built out this thing called Foldy it's basically like a hacked up 960 grid, and that's mm-hmm. basically it. And then we kind of have like some, you know, if you like surf around Trent's blog and stuff, he explains how like we kind of approach typography fluidly, and we just kind of build out these systems like based off of that. So yeah, Foldy's up on my GitHub if you're interested. I need to like fix it and brand it and do all that, but it's definitely it's just a really just bare bones grid, and it has like one media query. So it's kind of just saying like, here, it doesn't do much, so you got to figure it out, but it'll like help you get started. You know, it's just kind of a starter kit. So, and it's worked for us in most situations. That's why the only reason I recommend it. So.
Okay, Rodrigo, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, an hour later, Rodrigo wins the time waster question.
Let's spend like 3 minutes on this next one because it's so related to the stuff we were just talking about, but maybe we might have something to say. Josh Roundsville asks, as the projects that I work on become larger and larger, it has become obvious that my CSS could benefit from some planning before jumping into the code. What sort of process do you go through to prepare yourselves to write efficient code on large projects? Is there a prep process? Do you have to think, okay, this thing's getting big, I gotta better think about?
For me, I think the best way to plan for your next big project is look at everything that went wrong on the last one. just avoiding previous. You'll only learn something if you do it wrong the first time. That's certainly where a lot of my sort of, that's the IDs thing for me. Even after reading Nicole saying not to use IDs, I used one and I tripped up. So the next build, I didn't use any. So yeah, that's the first step. Just remember everything that's ever gone wrong previously. But I'm really lucky. I work with some really awesome designers. So we still do the fairly traditional PSD. I look at it. We sort of assess what's there, and then we start building. And at that stage, I just talk to the designers, and I look through the proposed designs, and I just grill the designers nonstop just for what is this component? What does it do? Are there any variations? I need to know everything about this. I need to know what class name to give it. I need to know what different states it might have. I need to know the rules behind it. And, you might see a button that's green. And is that green because it says save? Is it a save button? Or is it green because it's a confirm button? It's just things like that. Really get a thorough understanding of what everything means. And it'll make things much, much easier to build. I think if you try going with not enough knowledge and build what you presume to be correct or what you second guess is correct, that's often going to lead to tripping over yourself. Just make sure you fully understand everything you're doing before you get started. And smacks, Jonathan Snook's smacks, that'll help anyone out if they want to plan a large website.
Absolutely.
That's good advice. I would say, unless it's going to be just a one pager, and you know it's going to be a one pager for life, like read something like Smacks and just assume it's going to be a big deal. Say, what if this was Facebook? Like, that, start with that in mind. I think any site could benefit from that. So
totally, yeah, totally.
I think it's the planning, the pre-planning is part of it, but I would pre-plan to be flexible in the future or whatever. You know, some of these decisions you may not be able to make before you write any code, but just be like, okay, my plan is that if I start some new component or something, and it really makes sense, like my brain starts thinking about this component separately, this site didn't have grids before, but now I'm going to add grids to it, and I'm going to really get serious about what I'm going to do for grids. That's like I think of grids as like a chunk then, and because I'm naturally using Sass and Compass to organize this project, I'm going to make a CSS file called probably _grids.scss and just keep that stuff in a bit. Mm-hmm. And as I develop a project, all those little things that my brain thinks about as a chunk become different little files, and it lends structure to the project naturally. So I didn't necessarily think about those before I jumped into the code, but I as I build out, I was like, well, stay organized as you grow.
Yeah, totally. Nicole Sullivan said it, well, she put it quite well, when a lot of people, when they need to build a website, will look at building page by page, and Nicole Sullivan sort of says, well, look at your page and look a little deeper, look at your components that build that page up. So, like you said, these are little chunks of things that your brain recognizes, that you recognize, and treat those as individual things. So this isn't a homepage as footer, this is a footer. And then, you know, look a layer deeper, and then you can find out, well, maybe if I abstract this and treat this as its own chunk. And it may never, ever need to get reused on that site ever again. But as soon as it does, you've already pre-planned. And like you say, you've already got all partial to where that'll just solve the problems instantly. It's a really sort of sane way of working.
Absolutely. Speaking of Nicole, I talked to her this morning, and she's doing a thing. Your name came up. You're probably going to know.
Oh, what is it?
It's a thing. I can't tell you. It's a secret.
It's a thing about a thing.
I better not be on her hit list. I hope it's not that kind of thing.
No, it's all good. It's all good. She needs some people for a thing. So whatever. That's all I can say on the radio. I'll tell you about it off air. So what do we got? Do you got another one?
Yeah, here we go. Tim Chase wrote in and asked, can you offer any hints on how to understand the interplay of CSS transforms, rotation, scale, etc., with margins, padding, and absolute positioning? Height is height, except when it's rotated 90 degrees. When it becomes a width, can left, which I'm not sure if that's true, but can left become a top? And what is top left of an element rotated, say, 45 degrees?
This is weird, isn't it? Like, it's so, let's just set the stage, just so, because this is hard. It's one of those weird radio
Mind
things.
Yeah.
I feel like you just read some directions in reverse.
Let's say you have a div and it's 200 pixels wide and 100 pixels tall, right? So it's a long, it's a wider box than it is tall.
Wide rectangle. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
You got it in your brain? Let's say it's red. So we're all on the same page.
A wide red rectangle.
A wide red rectangle. And then you rotate it literally with using CSS transform. So transform, rotate, 90 deg.
Okay.
It goes, what? And it rotates 90 degrees. Now it looks like a narrow, tall 200 pixel red rotangle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you change its height, it looks like it gets taller, right?
Mm-hmm.
It does, right? So he's, you know, we're trying to like set the stage for Tim here to understand. It's not that those CSS properties change. You're still changing the height and width of the element. It just, it looks like height instead of width because of the rotation. Now, what Tim is asking is, what is the interplay of how that all works? I think what it means is, this is a kind of a good thing to know about rotations like this, is it leaves behind kind of like a ghost of itself, and then it rotates it. But like in the flow of the document, that 200 pixel by 100 pixel div is still kind of there. It just visually rotates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I don't know, I guess I think that's what he's asking kind of. So this is especially important when you're talking about left and top. And Tim's confused, like, what, let's say that box, instead of being rotated 90 degrees, is rotated 45 degrees. What happens to top and left? It seems like they have no meaning anymore because they're at 45 degrees. Well, it does. What it changes is the top left pixels of where that original ghost box was, and then it rotates.
So in our rectangle example, the corner at 45 degrees is going to be kind of poking up out of our ghost box, right? So the top of it is going to appear incorrect.
I think so. Where's the transform? Here's a CSS quiz for all of us. What is the default transform box. Point?
Transform box.
No, but is it top left or center center? It's one of the two. Oh, I can't remember.
That's a good question.
Like when you rotate, what is it?
Center center.
Center center. Okay. That makes sense. So when you rotate 45 degrees, it finds the exact center, the center center of what CSS would be center center of the box, and rotates around 45 degrees around that point. So yeah, it would kind of stick up or whatever. So if you change top left value, it's just going to scoot that 45 degree box, you know, to the right and down a little bit. It doesn't have anything to do with the top left corner of the rotated red box. It has to do with the ghost that's still there. Hopefully that makes sense.
Oh, that was a mind bender. Maybe it's time for a sponsor, Chris.
Let's do something easy. Yeah, the URL I want to send you guys for the sponsor for this week's show is 2013.incontrolconference.com. It is an in-person conference in Orlando, Florida. It's so early for this. It's in the early bird pricing. So it's $7.99 for it, which is pricey, but it's an incredible conference. It's like a best of breed in-person conference. And there's a discount code of Shop Talk Show, which is $100 off. So if you want to go to this conference, which is awesome, and I highly recommend it, and I've been to a number of them, and it's always one of my favorite conferences of the year, if not my favorite conference of the year. It's in Orlando, which I like, which means we could all have a thing where we do the drink around the world thing at the Epcot Center. That's on the table. Me and Dave are going to be there. Carl Smith, Ben Callahan, Megan Fisher, Josh Clark, Brad Frost, Zoe Gillenwater, Samantha Warren. Good lineup of speakers this year. I can't wait. I'm going. In fact, I'm going to be in what's that little island out off of Australia? New Zealand. Big island. It's like 700.
Captain America strikes again.
New Zealand for that one. That's going to be awesome. They're not a sponsor, so I can't give them too much. You got to give us money to be a sponsor. I'm going to fly right back right after it so I can be at this. So I'm excited about that. Thank you, Environments for Humans, for sponsoring. Please come to In Control Orlando. Yeah. We got another one. Let's do some more.
All right, here we go. This one's from Benjamin Solm, and it's a long one, suitable for audio, but here we go. As I've been getting deeper into Compass and SAS, I've realized that before Compass, I had terrible CSS organization. Me too. I had classes, tags, and IDs thrown in everywhere, and without Firebug, there's no way to know exactly where in a document a particular rule was without doing a find. Writing my styles in SAS has done a lot to fix this. All of my styles are now nested, but I've noticed that parent styles are still wander depending on how late in that particular element, how late that particular element was added to the development cycle. So let's say a list was added like the last day before launch. And so now he's just like, okay, list is at the bottom. So my question is, do you guys adhere to any specific conventions when organizing your style sheets? I know that performance is always the most important thing to consider when laying out your style sheet, but are there organizational guidelines that I should follow that will speed up my workflow? How do you
organize? I think the root interesting question here is that kind of like, dumb-to-dumb, doing my job, all of a sudden I need to style something new that I've never styled before. The temptation is to just open up some style sheet and just put it at the bottom or something.
Yep. You know,
how do you like stop and think and put it in the right place and make sure that it's adhering to your plan and yada yada? What, do you have any thoughts on that?
If you're working in the simplest rule to follow is. Your style sheet should always have bookends. If it's just one style sheet, your bookends would be at the top. You'd have your reset if you use a reset, or normalized CSS if you use that. The very, very last thing in a style sheet should be things like error states or your helper classes, you know, like your text center or your float left classes. Those two things should always be at the top and bottom, respectively. Everything else should come somewhere in between. So even if you're working on a tiny site with just one style sheet, ideally you'd never have anything at the end of the style sheet that isn't sort of a helper class. Just because you want to write your CSS in sort of a specificity order. I can't say that word. Every talk I end up doing, I have to say the word specificity. So even if you're not organizing with SAS or any preprocessor, you should find that the very first things in a style sheet are resets and things like that, and the very last thing should always be helper classes. Slot things in between. Try and chunk out into sections, so you'd have a section called tables or a section called page header or whatever. And if you write your CSS fairly modularly, I don't know if that's a word, you should be able to move these sections around quite freely. The temptation to bolt things on the end is definitely there, but I really think that should be avoided. But even if you're not working with SAS, I think that to just bolt things on the end of a style sheet is quite a risky thing to do.
Yeah. Indeed. I tend to not go more than three levels deep. That's kind of my like code sniff for like, uh-oh, this is getting super specific. So I need to maybe like either that could probably become its own module or something like that. Unless it's like a hover state or something like that, then it's I feel fine. But like three is kind of my number where I start to feel uncomfortable. But I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, that's quite a common. I've heard a lot of people mentioning the magic three. I think, Nicole's said that one before, and it's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Every time anything starts with a dot, you know, if you're about to write a new class name, and you're more than and you're nested, be like, do I need to be nested?
Yeah, totally.
And a lot of times I find no, just pull it down, pull it out.
Typically, the only things that I find nested are when I write CSS, I nest THs and TDs because you don't want a class on every TH or TD in a table. And LIs, I typically don't have those classed up because you can just do .nav li. Nesting, like if you're going more than three, I'd suggest there's some scope for some refactoring there.
Yeah. That's, you know, this relates back to the hot drama of this week too, in that of course you occasionally use descendant selectors.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, that was a weird thing where it's like that like kind of perception that came up that it's like, well, if you use classes, well, that means you just put a class on everything. You have like paragraph of class paragraph and stuff. You're like, no.
Yeah, that would totally never happen.
Yeah. So occasionally selectors are good. If, for example, list items and TDs and THs.
Just to go back to the question itself, it's just popped up in my Twitter feed. So to give Jonathan Snook another shout out, if you're worried about how you're, you know, if you do find yourself bolting things on the end of a style sheet, just give Smacks a read. In my opinion, it's one of the best things that's been written for front end developers in quite some time. So yeah, if you're struggling with how to organize your style sheets, what structure and what sort of anatomy you should be going with, I'd definitely go and read Jonathan's work.
I've had this idea once and I've never actually done it, but I feel like it relates to this question. So I'm going to throw it out there. Maybe somebody will use it someday. And then it's to have, like, if you're working in SAS or whatever, even if you're not, to have this like junk CSS file, like underscore junk.scss, and it just gets appended to your global or something. And if you just need a new style right now, because you don't want to hold up your brain because you just want to get it styled and get it out there and get it done. Like in some way, like just getting the work done sometimes can be the most important bit, or you don't want to lose your idea, just put it in junk, and then later when you're in your frame of mind is more like I have the time and mind space right now to refactor this and get it in the right place and be in that do right things with CSS mind space, then go then go grab all your crap out of junk and put it in the right place. I've never actually done it, but it seems like it.
Well, two points there then. One, I think I saw a talk of yours like online when you worked at Wufoo, and yeah. I think I can't remember you had like a CSS file for unique things. It's different to the current concept you're talking about, but I'm pretty sure I remember this correctly. You had just basically a file that held anything unique that didn't fall into any of the previous sections.
Possibly,
and that was a really nice idea. Just so if this doesn't live anywhere, rather than bolting it just on the end of a style sheet, sort of as an orphan. Just put it in like a miscellaneous sort of unique. You know, there's only one contact form. Therefore, don't bundle it with the form stuff. Put it in its own unique file. And with regards to the junk.scss, I work with a lot of software engineers whose job it isn't. They're not CSS architects. They're write a lot of really hardcore sort of server side stuff. But every now and again, they have to tinker with some CSS. And one of them actually came up with the idea you just spoke about. He had a misc.css, and anything that he thought might need some CSS work, he'd do in misc, and he'd just tell me, look, there's some more stuff in misc. Can you backport it into the framework for me? And yeah, so like you say, if you're in a rush or you don't have time to fully architect something, I certainly think that's a good idea. Just have a little miscellaneous .scss that you can bosh work in progress.
The system works.
Definitely do it.
That sounds awesome. I might try that. Even just use like junk class names that you know are junk. So
yeah, it's real handy as well. If you've got a file called junk.scss, it's a massive reminder that you've got stuff that needs taken care of. If you just try slot it in the style sheet somewhere, the chances are you'll think, well, it can stay there now.
Yeah.
If it lives in a thing called junk, you've got a fairly stark reminder
out
needs
your
to
mind.
Go. Exactly. Yeah. It's just call it guilt.css.
I like it. Well, we don't have a second sponsor this week, so I was like, you know what? I'm going to sponsor something of my own. Here's ways that you can give me money, like Dave asked.
Nice.
Anyway, I do want to talk about CodePen Pro, but it's not. We kind of missed our little internal launch date for it, unfortunately, but it's just because it's a massive update to what CodePen is going to be. It's full of awesome features, and I can't wait to tell you all about it, but I can't plug it just yet, so let's just skip it. Skip it and move on to the next... Yeah, it's going to be a sweet day. There's a huge refactoring of our CSS and stuff. It's not going to look entirely different. But, the features. The features. Ryan Ginnow asks, I saw a workflow video, thanks to Paul Irish, via Twitter, where Sublime Text 2 was used. There were many other third-party plugins for Mac in use that made it much easier for someone to code side-by-side with their browser and see the live updates happen. It was done with Divi and Live Reload. I don't have a Mac. I only have Windows. I tend to use... he says he has Linux Mint, too, and I tend to use Linux more often than Windows. I was wondering if you guys could talk about your workflows. If possible, find me some alternatives since I can't get Divi or Live Reload. So he thinks that workflow is really cool, where you have like your browser open on your left and your code editor open on your right. I'll admit I do that all day. That's my... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's how I rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And I really like, I use CodeKit, and CodeKit has that live update thing too, which is really, really cool. Live Reload did it kind of first, I feel like. I should say, Ryan, Live Reload, the one you mentioned, has a Windows Alpha. I've mentioned it a number of times. I've never actually used it as a not Windows user, but I would like to hear from somebody who uses Windows. Does the Live Reload Alpha work? I'd like to know, because it's pretty good software. Live Reload does not only this literally live reloading, like it's called, but it does all that pre-processing stuff too. So you can use it for your SaaS or less or whatever. But what do you think? Do we have anything else to tell Ryan? Like, how can you get a good workflow going on Windows?
Windows, there's an awesome app that I'm sort of alphaing at the moment called Mixtra. If you look up mixtra.io, it's a new app that I'm like really impressed with. That's by a group of developers from the UK. Mike Coos is involved with that. Definitely give Mixtra a shot. That works on Mac and Windows. I work on Windows at work and Mac at home. But he mentioned he works on Linux a lot, did he? Did he say
Linux? Yes. Mint. Yeah. I don't know what Mint means, but...
So, I'm not aware of any GUIs, but I think, and don't hold me to this, if he tweets at a guy called Got No Sugar Baby, Chris, he's the guy who came to Poland with me. don't you remember Jamie came to Poland?
I do, yeah.
He wrote something, I'm pretty sure he wrote something in either Ruby or Node, that a watch... directories, and of course, if it's Ruby and Node, you could do it straight onto your the cut through the command line on a Linux box. Tweet at Got No Sugar Baby, ask him your question, and he might be able to help you out, because I think he built something that does it, but I can't make any promises.
The chat room is saying they mentioned Mixture has live reload for Windows and Mac, and it works. And then Gray Ghost is saying Windows 7 and live reload is working together. So there you go.
And the official Compass app, Jitendra, is saying has live reload too. So that's a lot.
Yeah. And then, you know, I know Windows has like a auto kind of snap window thing. If you drag a window to the side, it'll like half it. You know, it's pretty intelligent. So I think that already exists in Windows, if I'm not mistaken. So you may have some of these features already cooking for you.
Mm-hmm. There's two left.
I think it's going to get better, honestly. Anyway, that's another soapbox I could get on, but.
I think I found the little script thing. I'm going to bosh it in the chat thing now, but I'll there we go. So that looks like the kind of thing. It's in the chat room now. My friend wrote this. It's a little Ruby
nerdy.
Like I said, he's a guy who came to Poland, but you should better run that without GUI. That might help him.
Cool. Awesome. Great. All right. Well,
I starred it. Starred.
It.
I was, when you look at a GIST, there's the star and the smiley face. And I'm always like, should I star it or I smiley face it? Mm. Seems like it. But they mean different things. Just don't like
it. I didn't even know you could click the smiley face. What does clicking the smiley face do?
It just tells you that it's public.
Right. I didn't want to, I've never you could click that.
Yeah, change that. Somebody at GitHub, you got to change. That's a terrible indication that it's public. A smiley face doesn't tell me. And you have to click it to tell you what it does.
Mm.
Oh, GitHub.
You've got to love GitHub, though.
Yeah, it's incredible. That's why I find it hilarious to pick on him for something so stupid.
It's like
the best software ever written.
And then it's like, smiley face, fail.
Sucks. I also spit. Just spit came out of my mouth and just splattered all over my screen. All right, we got to do one more, and we're going to do the audio one because audio questions are awesome.
Yep, we reward audio questions. Here we go.
Hey, guys. My name's Phil. I'm less from the UK. I'm just wondering, are you aware of any website or bookmarklet or Compass SaaS plugin that will take your CSS and then convert it and insert the rules to make it IE compatible? Because I'm forever trying to convert from, say, a WebKit version of my CSS into an IE-friendly one, and I find it takes up a lot of my time. So if you have any system that may do this for me, thanks so much.
Is there anything that automates kind of like IE hacks or fixes?
What would it do, though?
I think if that existed, every developer everywhere would know about it.
There's things, though. I mean, like, just Compass by itself means that you're using mixins for things that, you know, uses the right vendor prefixes so that they work on IE okay. You can do things like turn on experimental support for SVG true so that, like, your gradients work on IE 9, which they wouldn't otherwise. You can, you know, like what would the things be that it would help with?
Yeah, it depends. It's quite a broad question, isn't it? But you've got the mixins will give you your vendor prefixing. Leveroo, obviously, Shira, prefix-free, that'll help you. There's things like, is it CSS?
CS3Pi.
CS3Pi, but, I mean, they've got performance implications as far as I'm aware. Again, there's no one sort of silver bullet, is there? But, I reckon using a preprocessor to, or something like Compass to spit out your vendor prefix is a very good start.
I wish Phil gave us one thing to go.
I was just going to say, one thing I always, always constantly have a problem with is inline block. Like when I use it on like a navigation or something like that, it falls apart in IE7 and it's like janky wonky. So I make a mixin for any time I use inline block, like at include inline block, and it outputs the cross browser inline block, which I'm currently staring at a CSS Tricks article. But, you know, and you, Chris, you have actually some styles here that I would not personally do. But, like...
Chris doesn't know anything about CSS anyway,
What's the date of the article?
Oh, August 12th, 2009.
There you go. There you go. Relax.
Yeah. If, anyway, I use this inline block mixin all the time just because it's a pain in the butt to rewrite all those kind of, you know, it's little styles to get it to work. But yeah, that's what I do. And then, but yeah, maybe, I don't know. I mean, you could do one for at position absolute or something that like, you know, or a mix in for position. That may sound weird or counterintuitive, but you could just also bundle in zoom one so you don't forget it. Cause that'll kind of fix it on some older browsers. So yeah, I don't know. That's two examples I could come up with there.
Mm. Phil Thompson, if you have a specific example of something that continues to bite you in the butt, send it in and maybe we can give you a more specific answer in the future for that type of thing. But no, there is no silver bullet thing to make all everything work on IE.
I bet it's padding margin. That's the big one, isn't it? Mm. I don't know. Tough maybe. To tell. All right. Well, it's past that time, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, it's going quick.
Oh, yeah. It sure has. Harry, thanks so much for taking time out of your evening over there and joining the show. It. And I guess how can people follow you, give you money, do all that on the internet?
Yeah, well, just CSS Wizardry is pretty much my username everywhere. So, yeah, at CSS Wizardry on Twitter and GitHub if you fancy taking some free CSSs. You can find me there. My blog, CSSWizardry.com, for the last sort of 18 months, it's just about CSS architecture, OOCSS, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Very cool. All right. Well, everyone follow Harry. He's full of tips and tricks. And then thank you guys for listening. Thanks, everyone, for coming out in the chat room. We really appreciate you guys. You guys obviously kept us kind of true this episode. I was going to say somebody actually tweeted me and said the community forums for EE, for Expression Engine, they're still active apparently. So
yeah, I saw that too. So that's good that we did it. We don't have to do a follow-up and be like, oh, we are dumb idiots.
So that we already are being corrected by you guys. We really appreciate that. And yeah, follow us at Shop Talk Show.
To be fair, that we did read a blog article that said they were close. Anyway.
And then rate us in iTunes. And then you didn't hear this from me, but you should save up some money for a t-shirt later. But you didn't hear that from me. You didn't hear that from me. Okay? You didn't hear that. Chris, you got anything?
Shoptalkshow.com.